24 hours a day, 7 days a week. On demand, powerful talk radio. We global, and you can't do nothing about it. BashaniRadio.com. Always talking about everything. Keep it locked. Keep it locked.
Hello and welcome to the Secret Vibe Show. You're listening to your host, Valerie A. Campbell. And VIBE is an acronym for vision, intention, belief, and expectation. So how is your vibe today? Well, focus on what it is that you want, okay? Don't focus on negativity, focus on positivity. Now on today's show, I have got an amazing guest. His name is Roy Francis. Roy Francis is one of the well-known names in the gospel music scene, and with good reason. For many years, Roy worked for the BBC, producing its flagship religious program, Songs of Praise. And during that time, he won the coveted Christian Broadcasting Council's Gold Award for his program on Billy Graham. Roy was also responsible for the Donny McClurkin album Live in London and recorded the video that made him into a megastar. Welcome, Roy Francis, to the show.
Thank you very much. Very, very lovely to be here with you.
It's a pleasure to have you. Now, we are going to talk today on Windrush Women. Windrush Women. And let's discuss that topic. So, Roy, in what way were Windrush women affected by racism? I know it's a broad question, but what springs to mind?
A number of things. Well, Windrush women were affected by racism in the same way that men were affected by racism, black men were affected by racism generally, and then women would have some specific areas that were particular to them. So if we look at the areas in which generally black men were affected by racism, black women were likewise affected by the same thing. Racism in employment, get the low jobs, the worst jobs, the jobs that white people didn't want to do. Mm. So black people, and then women, it was worse because it's even worse for them. In not only employment and education, when some of the children came here to England, we were all put in schools, classes that people didn't think we were worthy to be in the top class. Mm. Because knew nothing about us, didn't understand us, think we had no sense, no brains. So there was, you know, racism there, racism in I said employment, in education, in work, in just everyday aspect of living. People used to call us names, call black people names. They used to write an all KBW, Keep Britain White. That made it clear that they didn't want anybody, didn't want any black people in their area. There was also racism in the church, pardon me, when black people went to the established churches, that's the Anglicans, the Catholic, the Methodist churches. They were shunned, they were ignored, and some were even told not to come back because their presence was upsetting the white congregation.
Wow.
So these are some of the things that generally people, including black women, suffered from as far as racism was concerned.
So you mentioned that there were some jobs that women had to do that the white counterparts didn't want to do. What sort of jobs were that? Because I remember from my day, there were a lot of jobs in the NHS. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, it's quite interesting because 1948, with the enactment of the Nationality Act, it was on that basis of that Act of Parliament that Caribbean people came to this country. As far as the women were concerned, they were recruited to do menial work. But even more specifically, some were recruited, the skilled ones were recruited to come and work in the National Health Service, so they became nurses. Mm-hmm. But majority of women that work in the National Health Service weren't nurses, they were nurses assistant.
Okay.
Because you didn't need any qualification to be a nursing assistant back in those days.
Oh, wow.
Days, no.
Okay.
In fact, it's only in the last 20, 30, 25 years or even 30 years, maybe even less, that you need a degree to be a nurse. You never once needed a degree to be a couple of O-levels, even CSEs back in the days. Mm-hmm. And even further back, to be a nursing assistant, you didn't need any qualifications. You just need to be trained on the job to do nurse. And people like things like make the bed, look after the patient, do the menial tasks, and those stuff that the white women, white girls, didn't want to do. And young Caribbean girls, young Caribbean, were very pleased, very glad to have a job, because their job was not just a job for the sake of having employment. It was a means to end, because by earning, they could then make enough money to send back home to their parents and their family and help their family to sustain and develop and grow.
Was it a lot less women than men that came over at that time?
Very much so, yes.
Right, why was that?
Well, just generally speaking, women at home in the Caribbean stay at home and look after the children.
Mm.
Yeah, and women were not encouraged, like now, to get up and go and, you know, and be adventurous.
Independent,
And weren't certainly not independent in the way that women are. And of course, don't forget, those women and men who are coming from the Caribbean, or men, they're going to the other side of the world.
Yeah,
most of them have
home.
Not even gone to the capital cities of their own countries.
Wow.
Most of them were rural people.
Mm-hmm.
So from the rural areas, it's very unlikely that you're going to get a host of women and you'll be courageous enough. In fact, their fathers wouldn't allow them.
Yeah, yeah.
And if they were married, their husband certainly didn't. Yeah. Wow. My father came here before my mother came to make sure. Once he had come here and see a couple of years, he was here for 2 or 3 years, everything was, then he sent for my mother.
Right, okay.
Then my mother, then my eldest sister came, and then subsequently we all came. And then those who were born here, was another family, so it's another dynamics, is interesting. So back in that day, 48, 49, 50, 60s, the government specifically recruited nurses from Barbados in particular, women to come and work in National Oil Service, and they recruited a lot of men to work on the buses.
Ah.
So a lot of Barbadians worked on buses.
Yes, yes.
And
they
recruited also
up.
People to go work on the railways and people in the construction industry. So all these jobs, apart from the nurses, were really unskilled jobs. And that's the reason the government allowed people from the Caribbean to come here, because the country was in the throes of redevelopment after the Second World War.
Right, so I can see that they would have needed the strength of the black men. So,
yeah, physically, because it's a lot of construction work. Mm-hmm. A lot of it was constructive.
Right, okay.
And they didn't have all the sophisticated machinery that they have now.
Yes.
When you lay tracks on a railway, you know, there's a machine that does that. Then it was masculine force, human strength.
Okay, okay. So how was it for Caribbean people coming over, you know, were very much spiritual people? Could you tell me about the religion, how they were able to settle here?
Well, interesting. Two things I want to say about that. I've just alluded to a group of people, Caribbean people, when they came here, they went to the established churches, the Catholics, the Anglicans, the Methodists, the Baptists, and they were generally rejected.
Mm.
Yeah. So a lot of them just didn't bother to go back after that.
Yeah.
But there was another group of people who came here who belonged to churches back home in the Caribbean. They belonged to independent churches.
Mm-hmm.
They belonged to churches like the New Testament Church of God, the Church of God of Prophecy. Something were Adventist, something were apostolic.
Right, okay.
Back in the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
So when they came here, that group didn't necessarily go looking to join an Anglican church. Some of them went, but that wasn't the intention.
Mm-hmm. Or the Roman Catholic.
Yeah.
Like my parents.
Yes, all right. Mm-hmm. But what that group who belonged to churches already, the independent church in the Caribbean, what they did when they came here, they looked for similar people to themselves.
Right.
Yeah,
okay.
They looked for other Pentecostals and they started to hold prayer meetings in their front room.
Together. Mm-hmm.
And that started simple prayer meeting. It usually was held on a Wednesday or Friday evening after work.
Mm-hmm.
It became very popular. It served a purpose of people meeting to express their faith, to pray. to testify, and at the same time to make friends and to support each other. So out of that prayer meeting on Sundays, then they then decided to hold Sunday services.
Yes.
And they made the room to look like a little chapel, actually, and, you know, a little church room. And that grew very popular, and then they moved to halls where they could expand and expand more. And then ultimately they bought their own places.
Yeah. Wow, they sound very entrepreneurial, actually.
They were, very much so. That age group and that generation, very much so, because the first thing they did was to buy a home.
Mm.
That some 80% of that generation had homes. They bought their own homes. They had to, because they couldn't get any mortgage. No finance house would give them any money.
Mm-hmm.
And they were able to do this through the partner system, which is a saving club device within the Caribbean community, not just the church, but in the Caribbean community. And they used that. So it created a problem with the working class whites, because they couldn't understand. Here, these group of people, within 3 years, they come here with nothing. They bought a house, to drive in fancy cars. I'm dressing like there's no tomorrow.
And black people can dress.
Yeah, I'm keeping swinging parties.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. My father bought a house here within 3 years.
Wow.
I don't know how he did it.
So how exactly did the partner system work for people that have never heard of it before?
It's very difficult to try and explain it here like this. But just take it from me. It's a saving club where everybody pool their resources together over a month or weekly or a set period of time. And each person in that partner takes out what is known as a draw. They take out all the money.
Yeah.
Yeah. At one stage. So every week, somebody gets all the money. And once they've got the money, they can do what they like with it. Mm-hmm. But then they subsequently pay back monthly to the end that they've paid back what they've taken out. And everybody in that partner, so it's 20 or 30 people, do the same thing until the last person has taken all the money that they've paid in, or those who paid in at the front pay back all the money.
Mm.
The advantage of that is that if you need it, say you're in a partner and it's worth £3,000-£4,000 in those days, it's big money, you can take all that in one go. So that means you can make significant purchases, so you can go and deposit in a house rather than having to wait 5 years to save up to do that.
Yeah.
And because you've deposited the house, you use the partner because you've got the money to do that. It's like a mortgage. Yeah. A mortgage is the building societies or the banks say, here's the money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'll lend you the money to go and buy the house. It's the same kind of
principle. I see that system very much in the Asian culture of today.
It's in the Asian, it's in the African culture. We still have it today.
Okay, but not as strong as...
Not as strong, but people still, I know people to this day run partners.
Mm.
Yes. And it's probably now more family-based than before. Before, it was family, but then the community was much smaller than it is today.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then,
people were more tighter. The spirit was much more tighter. And
the smaller numbers. Yeah. So it's more manageable.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what a lot of people now do it just confine it to their family.
Yeah.
Because they'll have control, and you know now people are not necessarily as scrupulous as they were before.
Mm.
So somebody join a partner, take that whole draw, take everything out, and disappear.
Yes.
In those days, they can't disappear. Everybody knew everybody.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah,
do you see what I mean? In their community, in their area.
Would you say that at that time as well, the Caribbean community were tighter? So it wasn't like, I'm of Vincentian, as you know.
Jamaican descent.
Barbadians. Were they very much tighter then, do you think, than they are now?
Generally, must be, because it was still smaller numbers.
Yeah.
The smaller numbers, you know.
So they had to rely on each other.
They rely on each other. They looked out for each other. They cared for each other. There were people who, you know, society was a little bit hostile. Mm. Not a little bit, quite hostile.
All facing the same.
Oh, yes, they're facing the same problems, the same issue. They, don't forget, they're here for the first time in a metropolitan, complex society.
Mm-hmm.
They had to navigate all that.
Mm-hmm.
Just see, navigating the bureaucracy of the officialdom must have been a nightmare.
Wow.
And a lot of these people came, they were, unfortunately, they were, you know, poor, working class people. They couldn't read and write.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So trying to, in a highly literate
and
society,
navigate around,
trying to navigate, just if you can't read and write,
mm-hmm.
just Just imagine, how do you get around?
Yeah, yeah.
Everything is signposted mm-hmm. in a metropolitan society.
Yes.
So they were very, very clever and very ingenious, and they obviously build up some schemes and ways and some ways of navigating their way, and that
yes.
sheer tenacity and that sheer
and that's
courage.
What helped them to
and
adapt.
That's what helped them to adapt and right. helped them to develop. And yeah. they've done remarkably well, because now they've left houses valued millions, you know, grandchildren, children now quabbling over, you know, 1.5, 1.7 million house that's been left by the grandparents.
Wow. Is that why, when I went to St. Vincent when I was 11 for the first time, and I got the impression, and I still kind of hear it to this day, that, you know, English streets are paved with gold. They seem to have that mentality. And I remember bringing, you know, having a suitcase, and they wanted everything in the suitcase, because they felt almost as if it was easy to acquire over here, not really realizing the struggle.
Yes, but it is a struggle for us, but believe you me, we're infinitely so much more better off
yes.
than they are.
Yes.
And that's where the idea, the streets are paved with gold, because right. there's more opportunities here.
Yes, yeah.
You can get by here, you can get an education here. This is one of the reasons why a lot of our parents' generation came here. Mm-hmm. They came here to give their children an education,
yes.
to give their children a chance in life that they couldn't possibly have.
Right.
And they can't pay for that in the Caribbean, an education those days. I think some of it's free. So people would come here, the opportunity is so much better, they could see.
Mm-hmm.
Because once they come over, they're earning, they send money back.
Yes.
So they
yes.
could see how quickly, and then people send photographs. Mm. Some would come over and go back. Mm. And they see how well they've done. They see the clothes they're wearing. They
yeah.
see the money that they can now splash out. They do it to this day, I tell
uh-huh.
you.
Yes,
you know, they
yes.
go off and show off on these people.
Yes.
And sometimes it creates such resentment.
I can imagine.
Such resentment.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
they come from nowhere. And all
yes.
of a sudden they're King B when they go back on holidays.
And showing off.
And showing off. And I
yes.
tell a lot of people in Expression Jamaica, I say, take no notice of these people.
Mm-hmm.
It's all on credit.
Mm.
It's all on credit. Yeah,
yeah.
It's all their credit card.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
When they go back to England, they've got to
yes.
pay all that back. Off.
Yes.
So don't take any notice of it.
Yes.
It's all on
yes.
credit.
Wow. So tell me, regarding the church, now, again, a contrast for me. I remember going back to St. Vincent and, for example, going to church, I wasn't allowed to show my shoulders.
yes.
Jewelry
yes.
was a no-no.
Yes.
Makeup was a no-no. Yes. The church has changed a lot from those days. How did that culture change? How did they settle down?
Well,
and how has it changed over the years? What caused that change?
Well, a number of things. Back in the days, back in that time, in the 40s, in the 50s and 60s, I'm talking about independent churches, not even independent churches. It was the same for white churches, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Because the idea of Christianity, generally, it's imbued, or it's expressed through a culture. Even a church culture, and the church culture of today, that in those days is that you couldn't wear makeup, you couldn't wear jewelry,
mm-hmm.
because those things were associated with sinfulness,
mm-hmm.
you know, lack of purity, lack
yes.
of fervent, being fervent to the faith.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it came from a lot of historically this puritanical view of being a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
You're pure, you wear simple things. It's a lot, there's a big historical
yes.
background to this.
Yeah.
I don't have time to go into it. But generally speaking, this then spilled over into Christianity, into Pentecostalism.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of a good Christian lady, who she was chaste, she wouldn't wear makeup, she was a bit dowdy, so she dressed like that. But
yeah.
she was deeply spiritual
yes.
and deeply fervent.
Mm-hmm.
The change, I think, came, as far as Pentecostal churches are concerned, when in the 60s, 70s, the first generation start to visit American black churches.
Mm.
And most of these churches, Church of God of Prophecy, Seventh-day Adventist, New Testament Church of God, their headquarters are in America.
Right, okay.
In southern states of America,
mm-hmm.
that's another story, that.
Yes.
Southern states of America. So what they saw shocked them.
Mm.
Because here were all these women dripping.
Uh-huh.
Dripping in jewelry.
Yeah.
Dripping in makeup. First of all, they saw that the leadership was white. That shocked them, because in Britain, the leadership is black, was black, and the congregation was mainly black. Now they go to the headquarters church, the leadership was essentially white. Hardly the black person was in leadership. So that kind of made them think, hang on, what's going on? Secondly, all these women were wearing all these makeup and dripping with these makeup and jewelry, when in their own church, this was considered a sin. Now, if it can work in the mother church, why can it not work in the church over here?
Okay.
So what happened when they came back? A lot of women challenged this. A lot of black Christian women challenged this view, challenged their view of their pastor, their church. Now, unfortunately, rather than say, well, if it's working in the mother church, nothing's wrong in the satellite church. In no, they didn't. They held the line thinking, well, it is still wrong. It is still sinful. It is because it's coming back from the Caribbean.
Yes.
And some of the women just thought, well, I'm not having this. And then at the same time, this was a time when women were becoming more expressive, becoming more independent, working for themselves, making their own decision. They all questioned women liberation as an idea of independence were coming through in society in the 70s and 80s, 60s and 70s. And he said, I don't need this. It doesn't stop me being a Christian.
Yes.
It didn't stop those American women with their jewelry. They're still used by God.
Yes.
So the women said, I have to do that. So some women left and joined the new independent churches that was springing up all over London and other parts of the world. Or they remained and took no notice of the pastors about what they were.
Okay, rebellious women.
Yes.
Okay, so another thing I remember growing up is every Sunday, my parents put on, you know, the country music.
Jim Reeves.
Yes. And even going back home when I was little, the same thing again. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Caribbean Christians love Jim Reeves. They love Jim Reeves. They've always loved it. In fact, Caribbean people like country and western. It's the influence of America that's come to the Caribbean. See, what a lot of people don't realize is that, I can speak specifically of Jamaica. Jamaicans didn't really want to come here in 1948, 1950 onwards. Not really. They wanted to go to America. America was really the natural place that they wanted to go to, not necessarily England. Yeah. Same with the Caribbean.
Okay.
But what happened, America passed a law, it's called the McCarthy Act. And what it did, it reduced the number of Caribbean people go to America to work. It reduced it to 100. It used to be hundreds and hundreds, 100 only per country.
Yeah.
So obviously it's not enough for people looking for opportunities. So what they did, they realized that they could come to England.
Yes.
So because of that, they turned the attention to England. But that wasn't originally their first
place of destination or preference.
So the influence of American Caribbean culture and Caribbean politics has always been big, and it's huge. Jim Reeves, they've always liked the spiritual side of Jim Reeves. They like Jim Reeves' gospel song. And I think it's something to do with two things. They're wonderful songs, wonderful hymn, and his very soothing voice. He's got a very soothing voice, Jim Reeves. I know in England when things were rough and hard and people were lonely and sad and missed home, missed family, that Jim Reeves voice must be so reassuring. I can remember it in my home. My parents will always play, "Where do I go from here? What fate is drawing near? Touch my heart and something, something in prayer." You know, it's all, now I look back when I was writing a book, I said, do you know, in a funny way, this is them. This it was soothing to them. This is reflective. This the song and Jim Reeves would just encapsulate what they were feeling and articulate it musically.
Yes.
And they warmed to him. A lot of Jim Reeves songs were sung in churches. Another one was Ernie Ford. A lot of his songs were sung in churches. And
what was his name?
Ernie Ford. Yeah.
Okay.
The difference is that his songs could be put to a beat in a way that Jim Reeves couldn't. So his songs were sung even more. They became choruses in our churches. Now, the epitome.
Could use the tambourine.
Yes. If your song becomes a chorus in a Pentecostal church, trust me.
Yeah, black people do love a beat, don't they?
Big time. You've arrived. You've hit the jackpot in those churches. And this, and he was a country and western singer as well. Mm-hmm. Most of his songs became choruses.
Mm.
Yeah. Have a little talk with Jesus. Tell him about your trouble. Hear your faith is crying. Answer by and by. When it is something, have a little talk with it. It's only four songs. Become a chorus. There's tons of them. Mm-hmm. It's all in my book anyway.
Okay. Yeah. And my last question, I've got time, the food. The food must have been so different. I remember my dad, again, he would travel back to the Caribbean for 6 weeks at a time. He worked at Buckingham Palace while he was here.
Mm-hmm.
And when he would come back, I remember opening up the suitcase and the smell, you know, he would bring home the mangoes, you know, the bush. He would bring back a soft candle.
Oh, when he's gone, he's coming back, and the scent as he opened up that case. Yes.
And the wafts, you know, of the different fruits and the... And I say, what is this one? And, he would explain what it was. How did, coming across in the Windrush, how was cooking influenced? Because I'm sure at that time, the foods.
Well, back in the early days, the food weren't here.
Mm.
They weren't here in the way that they are here now. Anything is in the Caribbean now is mm-hmm. here. I'm talking the 50s and 60s, they couldn't possibly have.
I
don't know, but I know rice must be. They do is make use of what the natural ingredients here are. And spice up the food like how they cook it. I remember when I was growing up, my mum used to fry baked beans.
Put onion and tomatoes, cut it up. Yeah, and the corned beef as well.
As for corned beef, it was a staple diet.
You always had corned beef in the cupboard.
Absolutely. And then back in the days, lamb's neck was the cheapest meat.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Cheapest meat. It's expensive now. It wasn't then.
Yeah.
So you buy lamb's neck. Roast it, cook it, season it up, do all kinds of something in there. Heighten the taste. So it's not just lamb's neck, boring lamb neck. People used to make this thing, like a gourmet meal when they finished with it. And they did that with a lot of the natural ingredients that was found here.
Because English food, by comparison, is quite bland.
It was bland, not now, but it was then, it was very, very bland. Very bland. The other thing that is very expensive now is codfish. It was the cheapest.
Yes, that's right. It was the cheapest fish once. Yes, yes.
It was the cheapest fish.
And now look.
And
corned beef has gone up as well.
When my mother fried that codfish, God almighty, and serve it on a bed of rice and, some vegetable, something else.
Or we'd have it with carrot juice. Bakes.
Yeah.
We call bakes. You say fried dumpling.
Oh, breakfast back in my days, breakfast was a meal.
Yes.
Sunday breakfast, let's say, was a meal. And one of the reasons is, I've subsequently gathered, is because church was so long. So mum would get up and we would have roast dumpling, fried dumpling, beg your pardon, fried dumpling, liver, callaloo or some spinach or something, an egg and bacon, all that.
Wow, really set your stomach
set
for that
your
long
stomach, because church we used to get to church, church start 11 o'clock, my father was a minister, so that means they are at least 3/4 hour before, so that's 10:15.
Yes,
church would finish about 3 o'clock. There's a long day for a young person, young children, and we sat through it. No sweets, no eat, no sandwich, no nothing. We sat through all that, so that's 3 o'clock. By the time you get home, it's 4:30, 5 o'clock. So you haven't ate.
Yeah. Wow.
For good 4 hours, 4 or 5 hours.
Wow.
So that's why I realized, that's why she used to pile us up with the food early in the Sunday morning. So yes, they make good with what they have.
Yeah, and porridge in the mornings.
Porridge, cornmeal porridge. Exactly. So they made good with the natural ingredients that they could find. I'm talking in the 50s and 60s. And cook it in their own cultural way to make it palatable.
As close as they possibly could.
Until
start to import.
Business start opening and start to import food, because they realise there's a market for Caribbean food. Now, today, there's everything. So even when I go to Jamaica on holiday, there's no point me bringing anything back.
Yeah, because it's here already.
It's what I tell my family. They don't do it so much now, because I go regularly. But back in the days, my family said, no, you have to take this for your mommy and daddy. Mm. I said, no, Grant, no, everything is in England. I don't need to bring anything. Mm. But in a funny way, my parents, they used to like to have something back.
Yeah.
The very thought of somebody have got, their auntie or their mm-hmm. sisters or their brothers.
Send them something. That personal touch.
So from that point of view, I used to take something, but not too much. Now I don't take anything at all.
Yeah. So, Roy, you've got a new book out. Tell us about that, because we're running out of time.
The book is called How to Make Gospel Music Work for You. It's a funny old thing, because it was written for gospel artists, how to navigate their way as an artist in today's changing environment within the music industry. But in order to write that, I thought it was necessary to give a background to the music, how gospel music in this country has developed from West Indian church music to become the gospel music today. So the book is actually two parts. The first part is the whole Windrush generation, because that's how the music developed. The mm-hmm. second part is like a manual, it's a how-to. So the two parts of the book is that. But because it was essentially written for young gospel artists, it's called How to Make Gospel Music Work for You. But I'm going to do something, because I'm getting a lot of interest from the first part of the book, so I mm-hmm. may have to do something that expands the first
24 hours a day, 7 days a week, on demand, powerful talk radio. We global, and you can do nothing about it. BashaniRadio.com. Always talking about everything. Keep it locked.